A major war contractor is expecting a $45 million check from the U.S. government. A military appeals board has sided with Kellogg, Brown, and Root in its quest to get the government to reimburse it for security in Iraq. Now, KBR paid out of its own pocket for private guards to protect convoys carrying supplies to the U.S. military. We take a close look at the five-year legal battle in this week's Legal Loop with procurement attorney Joe Petrillo. Hi, Joe.
Good morning, folks.
So, Joe, first of all, tell us what happened.
Well, this case, it came out of KBR's huge LogCap 3 cost-plus contract to support troops in Iraq. KBR had a subcontractor that had the obligation of feeding all the troops at major bases throughout Iraq. And part of that involved getting supplies to those bases by using truck convoys. The contract provided that the coalition military would provide protection for the contractor and its convoys, and it restricted the possession of weapons by contractor employees. Now, in the summer of 2003, the security situation deteriorated, and coalition troops were unable to provide protection for the convoys, and they were being attacked. There were casualties. There were people who died on these convoys, and many of the trucks were stolen or otherwise missing. And supplies were getting delayed. So KBR initially went to the coalition and said, look, you've got to provide more protection. And their response was, we have other priorities. So, you know, you'll have to, you know, you're just going to have to wait until we can gather together adequate security for your convoys. At that point, it looked like the supplies would be delayed and the troops weren't going to get fed. So KBR's subcontractor went out and hired a private security contractor to provide force protection for the convoys. They did that. The convoys started getting through, and the troops were fed. But some years later, the auditors came by and said, wait a minute, you've been spending money for private security contractors, and the contracting officer decided that was inappropriate, and they withheld $44 million from payments otherwise due KBR. So KBR goes to the Board of Contract Appeals, the Armed Services Board, and says, we want our money back.
And so it took this long to get it back?
Yeah, this case has been going on for a long time. There were many, many days of hearings, over 20 days of hearings in the case, lots of testimony, lots of back and forth about what was actually going on the ground, and the board issued a 47-page opinion laying all this out.
We should point out, too, that LogCap 3 was multiple tens of billions of dollar contract and had its own problems, you know, with some of the prime work being done there. But so this is really a very tiny portion of the whole expenditures through LogCap 3. And so is the issue that whether the contractor was authorized to hire that security themselves or whether it had to be the government that hired it in order to get any kind of security done, in which case there would have been no reimbursement issue.
Exactly. So the contract says the government's going to provide security. You're in Iraq. The government is unable to. They're you know, quite occupied trying to keep the lid on things. And, you know, the contractor goes out and gets its own. So what happens then? The government argued a few things. One, they said, look, the contract prohibits the possession of weapons by contractor employees unless you get a special dispensation. The board looked at that provision in the context of where it was in the contract and the other things it prohibited, like possessing pornography or religious proselytizing, and it really thought that that provision affected individual contractor employees keeping weapons for their own self-protection. It didn't really apply to force protection for the convoys. So the board held to the contractor on that issue. And then the government's other position was, well, we're going to provide the force protection, so if we can't do that, your remedy is delay. And the board was scathing in its criticism of that position. It said, fortunately for the troops who were, you know, relying on KBR for meals, they didn't take that route. They went ahead and solved the problem, and you know, now they've got to get the money that they spent doing that. And finally, the board also found that government officials, including the contracting officer, you know, knew that KBR was using private security, but They didn't stop the practice, and they didn't warn KBR that the costs were unallowable.
Well, and presumably they didn't because the company was providing these needed supplies. I mean, they needed the military to get whatever it was, food or supplies of some other sort.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, KBR, at the end of the day, was focused on the mission performing the contract, and it was pretty clear that that they absolutely had to get additional help or else they were not going to be able to perform the contract. I mean, they couldn't run these convoys without protection, and whenever they had no protection or inadequate protection, people were injured, people died, and trucks were taken away. So
what is the principle this case turned on? Was it something in the DFAR, or was it a bigger principle involved that, that gave such a harsh ruling against the government?
Well, the principle was basically, let's look at the performance of the contract. Let's look at the contract as a whole. Let's interpret it in accordance with the contractual objectives. And so from a legal standpoint, it's unexceptional. But, in terms of a policy implications, I mean, if you're a contractor who is considering getting one of these contracts in the future, you have to factor into your calculation that in addition to all the risks you have, being deployed in a contingency area, when you get back home, people are going to be, second-guessing the decisions you've made under those circumstances, and you're going to have to be spending some time and effort with lawyers and others vindicating your positions.
We're speaking with Joe Petrillo, a procurement attorney at Petrillo & Powell. And given the fact that this legal battle has taken 5 years, do you think the precedent has already been set and that contractors have already been learning from what's been going on with KBR?
Well, absolutely. I mean, this isn't the only case involving KBR. There are lots of others, and some of them are going against the company. So, I mean, there's a considerable programmatic and legal risk in these contracts. The government's learning, too. I mean, they've tightened up the contract clause involved here. So the next time this type of situation happens, it may, in fact, be the case that the troops don't get fed because, unless the contractor gets authority quickly to go out and augment its force protection, those convoys aren't going to move.
Well, this might be a little far-fetched, but suppose in a more ordinary contract situation, say the government says the ice cream has to arrive cold. I'm just making that one up. But the trucks that are available to the contractor are not refrigerated, and they go out and put in those refrigerators that make trucks cold. Would that then be considered something that the contractor could reasonably expect to get reimbursed for?
Well, I think it's kind of foreseeable that you need to have refrigerated trucks to move ice cream. So I'm not sure.
So maybe not.
That scenario is going to work too well. Like this case, like many others, it turns ultimately on its facts. And the facts here were compelling that in this military exigency, KBR acted reasonably and performed the mission. The fact of the matter is they weren't the only ones doing this. According to the opinion, there were at their peak, there were roughly 30,000 private security contractor personnel in Iraq. So this was just the way contractors had to operate. It was not unextraordinary in this circumstance.
And as you read the legal opinion, how broad is it? Is it narrowly written to only deal with this case, or do you think that others in future circumstances or perhaps in circumstances similarly will be able to point to this as an example?
Well, it's both. I mean, on the one hand, the contract turned on the specific language that was used. I mean, the case turned on the specific language of the contract and the particular circumstances the contractor found itself in. On the other hand, the principle of, let's look past the minutiae at what is important here and make sure that we're focused on that and we're interpreting the contract and the circumstances consistently with that. I mean, that's an important principle, and that's what courts have to do. you know, the arc of our operations in Iraq changed the way the contract was being interpreted. Initially, we were in the cakewalk stage where we'd come in, liberate Iraq, and say goodbye. And at that point, force protection, you know, was something that the coalition forces thought they could provide. When the security situation deteriorated, force protection was no longer something the security services could provide. And the contract wasn't changed, but the contractor needed to adjust to that. And then years later, we've got 30,000 security personnel running around Iraq. Some of them are doing things that aren't looking very good and getting the coalition in trouble. And so they're seen to some extent as a negative, as a detriment. And so the attitude changes once again. You know, a contractor going into these circumstances has to realize that there's got to be flexibility, and things are going to be unforeseen. Things are going to happen. And fortunately, the board for the contractor looked at that and interpreted the contract in a flexible way.
And just one detail here I wanted to ask you about. It looks like the judges were kind of annoyed with how long it did take. At the very last page, they say, we've considered the government's numerous objections to the presiding judge's rulings, limiting discovery, the number of documents, testimony of witnesses, pages of brief, blah, blah, blah. And it said these proceedings had to end at some point, and limitations on discovery, witnesses, documents, and pages of briefs did not violate the board's rules or discretion inherently granted to tribunals to control their proceedings. Does that mean they were impatient to get on with it and stop all the legal maneuvering?
Well, I think this case, the hearing went on for weeks, and other proceedings went on for years. So, the board's basically saying enough is enough. We had 24 test witnesses, 37,000 documents. At some point, we've got to put a limit on this, and we've got to focus on what's important here.
Well, that's why you all have interns, right?
that's an interesting point. All of this stuff has to get funneled through the mind of a single judge and help with a couple of law clerks. So judicial attention and time is a scarce resource, and lawyers should be mindful of that when they approach a case.
And, Joe, just as a final question here, you know, the company, right after this ruling came out, they said they are going to immediately pursue the money that they say is $45 million because it includes some interest, maybe more. How soon will they get it, and will they really get it?
Well, the government does have an appeal right, and so it may take a couple of months before the government decides whether or not it wants to appeal. If it does appeal, the company's not getting any money right away. If an appeal takes place, if there's no appeal, then the company should be paid pretty promptly.
Well, they've got a pretty good overseas contingency operation budget for the next couple of years. They ought to just pay them and lick their wounds and go away. Joe Petrillo is a procurement attorney with the law firm Petrillo and Powell. Joe, as always, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.